The next case on the court's calendar is in the matter of the welfare of DKBW, and we are ready for arguments. Would each attorney be sure to introduce themselves for the record immediately before providing argument?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gina Schultz. I'm an assistant appellate public defender, and I represent DKBW, who I would be calling D today.
Could you speak up just a touch?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Your Honor. I will. The district court made two significant errors in this case. The first by basing its credibility determinations on D's status as the accused, and the second by imposing a duty to retreat in a case involving defense of others. Each of these errors reinforce the other, and both independently require a reversal of D's adjudication of first-degree assault. I'll start with the first. The district court clearly erred by finding that D was less credible, and by extension, HD, because he had the most to lose.
Could you start by telling us what standard of review applies to that argument?
Yes, Your Honor. We argue that it was clear error, because a credibility finding is a factual determination.
Okay. Well, the rules and case law clearly establish that we give great deference to the credibility determinations made by the finder of fact. Indeed, in some cases, even when there has not been an express determination, we imply a determination based on the outcome at trial. And I do think there is case law, admittedly, saying we defer to credibility determination so long as there is record in the evidence to support it. Do you agree that those are the standards?
I agree that there is great deference to the district court's credibility determinations.
Do you disagree that there's evidence in the record to support the district court's express determination of credibility?
I disagree that that deference is absolute. And here,
okay, and I agree with you. It's not absolute, but my understanding of the case law is it's not absolute to the extent that there is no record evidence to support the credibility determination.
That's certainly what those cases that we cited say.
So but wouldn't we apply those cases since that is the case law?
This is a different kind of situation. This is not just where the witness was so incredible and there's no evidence supporting that witness's testimony that this court takes the extraordinary step of overturning a credibility determination. That's what happened in those cases. That's not what happened here. Here the district court said, my credibility determination is based on the fact that he has the most to lose.
Okay. Was the district court required to explain its credibility determination?
No, not at all, Your Honor. And had the district court just said, I find him to be less credible and HD to be less credible, we wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have raised this issue.
So it's always best to say less rather than more.
If you're going to base your credibility determination on an impermissible factor, then yes, that's true.
What an impermissible factor? What would an impermissible factor be?
Well, Your Honor, here, where the sole determination is that he has the least to lose, that's not based on anything in the trial record. And so it's based solely on the fact that he's the one on trial.
Well, it's based on common sense, because the person who's facing the criminal charge and the consequences generally has the most to lose. Is that inconsistent with the jury instructions? I mean, don't the jury instructions say consider the witness's interest in the outcome of litigation?
The jury instructions do say that, but we don't actually have any case law applying that to the defendant in these kinds of circumstances where
it is
the
tiebreaker. Well, that's because we defer to the credibility determination.
Well, I don't think we have a case where the district court had said, because you are the one standing trial, I find you less credible. And that's what happened here.
So you're suggesting that we would issue a published case saying a district court errs by basing a credibility determination on a finding that the defendant had the most to lose?
Certainly when it is solely that factor. And I think this court doesn't need to reach the issue of when it is appropriate to consider that when a defendant is on the stand. But here the defendant is protected by the presumption of innocence. And I think what happened here is that the district court was faced with a lot of different conflicting testimony without any really good reasons to choose one over the other, and in the end said, well, the respondent had
but
the most to lose.
How often is it the case that we have a trial and we have the victim and the defendant giving opposing testimony regarding what happened, you know, who started the fight? I mean, this is a common scenario. in the case law, and we always and then when we get a challenge, sufficiency of the evidence, we say, well, we assume the jury believed the victim and not the defendant. We defer.
Yeah, absolutely. But here we have the district court saying that it based its credibility determination on an impermissible factor. And that was the fact
but
that he was the one on trial.
Why is it impermissible? Impermissible would be race. Impermissible, because to me this is very analogous to request for a downward departure. The district court has to explain why it gives an upward departure. The district court is not required to provide any explanation if it rejects a request for downward dispositional departure or downward durational departure. There is one case that I'm aware of in which this court said we're reversing the denial of a downward sentencing departure because the court said he was denying it because of the behavior of people in the audience at trial. And we said, that's completely impermissible. You can't punish the defendant based on what people were doing in the audience at trial. How does the district court saying he had the most to lose equate with that scenario in terms of what is an impermissible reason on which to base a credibility determination?
For two reasons. First, that the defendant is protected by the presumption of innocence. And here, when there's no reason to believe any particular piece of witness testimony over the other, the district court said, okay, as a tiebreaker, because he's the one on trial, he has the most to lose. And that's the case for almost every criminal defendant. And, of course, we've argued here, and I think it's true, that it's not necessarily true here. But that's not even
exactly what we're... But if we accept your argument, I think we'd be issuing a decision that is inconsistent with thousands of cases that say where at trial the complaining witness says one thing happened, the defendant testified that another thing happened, the jury says guilty, and we say the evidence was sufficient. The jury obviously accepted the complaining witness's testimony.
I completely disagree.
And what you're saying is, well, no, they can't do that because the defendant's presumed innocent, which absolutely he is.
I disagree, Your Honor, because I think the juries are always instructed the fact that the defendant is on the stand, you cannot draw any inferences from that. You can't infer guilt from the fact that he's been brought before you by the normal processes of the law. And so when a jury determines that a defendant is less credible, we don't know what goes into a jury verdict when they
But doesn't the jury instruction say, again, you consider the witness's stake in the outcome?
Yeah, but the laws
in any criminal case where that instruction has been given, according to your argument, that was an error because that instruction would not duly respect the presumption of innocence of a testifying defendant.
Well, we know that in State v. Underwood, the Minnesota Supreme Court said you can't say in particular that the defendant has a special interest in the case, and the jury has to base its decision on facts in the record.
But
they can't hear any evidence about the potential consequences. I apologize, Judge.
No. I apologize for interrupting your argument. You know, I did pull the Underwood case, and, you know, there was a lot of really bad stuff in that case.
Mm-hmm.
The defendant has given his testimony and you are the judges of the weight. His testimony should be weighed. He is directly interested in the result and determining the weight. You know, I would agree with you there, Ms. Schultz, that the district court did seem to be putting his weight on the scale and arguably punishing the defendant who's presumed innocent. You know, I understand the point you're making, which is it seems like the district court was saying because he's the defendant, because he's the defendant, I'm not going to believe him. Now, in all fairness to the district court didn't say that, right? I mean, if he had said he's the defendant, and therefore all defendants lie, you know, you win. But he didn't say that, isn't saying he had the most to lose a different way of saying interest or lack of interest in the outcome of the case? I mean, is it so clear that he was shifting the burden of proof and punishing the defendant because the defendant testified and should not have been presumed innocent.
I think it is, Your Honor. Okay. Because perhaps it's a different way of saying interest in the case, but that's also a different way of saying that he's the defendant in this case and has the most to lose. And if there was some kind of evidence in the record, you know, say that all of the other witnesses were completely disinterested, they had no connection to the case, they weren't injured, they weren't, you know, maybe that would be a different situation because then we really have a good reason to believe witness testimony when there's no. But these are not disinterested witnesses. If this were a civil case and the plaintiff had presented just enough evidence that the district court didn't really know who to believe, then the burden of proof would be dispositive. The judge would say the plaintiff had the burden to prove a preponderance of the evidence, the strength of his claim, and he didn't. And so he loses. And I think that's what happened. I think the opposite happened here. I think what should have happened is that if the state didn't present enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that D had committed this assault, then the state loses. And that's how the presumption of innocence should have been applied here. And instead, it was flipped. They said because you know we've sort of gotten to 50-50 or something around there, we're not going to believe the defendant because he had the most to lose. And I
Counsel?
Think that is improper.
Does your argument focus solely on the language at the end of paragraph 9 of the order? I'll just read it. Weighing the testimony of all the witnesses and the evidence in this case, the court finds the testimony of respondent and his friend to be less credible due to what respondent has to lose and the long friendship between them.
That's certainly the anchor of our argument because that's where the district court tells us exactly it did what it did.
So I don't read that. I see him saying due to what the respondent has to lose. I don't see him saying because respondent is the respondent. Is there some place else in the order where the district court makes it clear that it's the status of the respondent other than the what's at stake piece that weighs in this credibility determination?
No, there is nowhere in the order where the district court says that. But our argument is that because there's nothing in the trial record to show that he does or does not have the most to lose, then that determination is based solely on the fact that he's the one on trial. That's saying the same thing, that he has the most to lose because he's the defendant, and because he's the defendant, he's less credible. And if that is permissible reasoning, I think that rather than, you know, us prevailing here, overturning fully established case law, I think if we lose.
If the facts were, we didn't have three eyewitnesses, and it was a circumstantial evidence case, and the defendant took the stand and said, I didn't do it. You've got the wrong guy. That's not how it happened. There's clearly case law that says in those circumstances, the fact finder can nonetheless reject the defendant's testimony, even though there's no other direct evidence. Here, however, we have direct evidence, I think, in the form of three witnesses who said, yep, he did it. I mean, I just don't see how you reconcile these facts with the case law and say, well, this credibility determination can't stand where you have three other witnesses. When case law says the testimony of one witness is enough, and case law also allows a finding of guilt where there is no direct evidence.
Well, and Your Honor, that is why we raised this issue as one of clear error rather than sufficiency. Because absolutely, this court would review this evidence and say, you know, there was at least one witness saying that it happened in this way.
So you're not arguing sufficiency. So if we were to reverse, there'd just be a new trial.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yeah. The state, I think, has a point that what I'm saying is that the only way to read the district court order is that without this thumb on the scale, he wins. And without the thumb on the scale, there's not enough evidence. But I do think, you know, the way we raised it is it is a trial error. I think it makes the most sense to send it back to the district court. But certainly it's within this court's authority to find that the evidence would be insufficient without this impermissible finding and reverse his conviction or his adjudication outright. And we obviously would have no problem with that.
Schultz, I was on rebuttal, because we haven't heard your second argument. And I'd just like you to think about this question. Do we have to get to your argument that the district court misapplied the rule of self-defense when the district court clearly found that the victim didn't throw the first punch? And so if, well, do we have to even get to it? Because I think all of your thoughtful brief flows from that. And, you know, as you know, I'm a coward, and if I can avoid an issue, I always do. And it seems to me the easiest way to avoid the issue is to say, well, that's all fascinating, but that's not what the district court found, therefore we don't have to determine whether or not in the hypothetical situation the rule of self-defense applies or not. Ms. Schultz.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will answer that on rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Schultz.
And who is appearing for the state?
Good morning, and may it please the court. John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The district court did not err in its credibility determinations or in applying the law of self-defense, and this court should affirm. Judge Connolly, to answer your question, no, you don't have to get to the second issue if you find that the defendant was the aggressor. That's State versus Richardson, Minnesota Supreme Court 2003 case. The aggressor has no right to claim self-defense. So you wouldn't need to get to that second issue. As to the first issue, the district court, the case really boils down to who threw the first punch. The district court clearly found it was the appellant threw the first punch, and it used the model jury instructions to base part of that determination. And within that, it is the interest or lack of interest in the outcome of the case, the relationship of the witnesses to the other parties.
Right, and I appreciate Ms. Schultz's thoughtful argument. Here's my problem with your case. So the civil jigs clearly say when you evaluate a witness, one of the factors is will a witness gain or lose if this case is decided a certain way. The crim jigs obviously don't like that, I assume for all the reasons Ms. Schultz has articulated, and simply say interest or lack of interest in the outcome of the case. So in looking at the district court's order, on page 12, you know, the district court correctly got the crim jig right in, the first full paragraph, but then seemed to stray from that and apply the jig that shouldn't have been used in this case. And if that's true, if we take a look at this and say, you know, it seems like the district court was applying the wrong jig. And I know you say, I get it, you're saying they didn't. But if we say, no, he did, is that reversible error?
You know, for one, yes, I don't think he applied the wrong jig. Okay. But for two,
I was almost confident.
Yes.
Supremely confident you were going to say that. But let's say we disagree and we think, no, you know, it's a mix and match here. And if it's a mix and match and he applied the wrong jig, the civ jig, not the crim jig, is that reversible error?
No, because I think in the court's analysis, saying who has nothing to lose and using the word lose, and I mentioned this in my brief, that seems to be the main argument for appellant is that it's about who has more to lose or not lose. It's that word. I think that's just another way of describing the interest or lack of interest in the outcome of the case. It's just a shorter way to get to the same point.
What if this was a jury case and the district court gave the civ jig instruction, will a witness gain or lose if this case is decided in a certain way versus interest or lack of interest in the outcome of the case, and then the jury just, you know, convicts? Would that have been reversible error?
If you're using the civil jigs in a criminal case, that gets a lot closer to reversible error. I think the standard for evaluating.
I think it is reversible error.
Yeah.
Speaking for myself, I mean,
sure.
Obviously, for whatever reasons, the jig committee, you know, composed of everybody, said
okay for civil, not good for crim. And here, the district court, well, the district court seemed to do a little bit of both. So is your better argument that, you know, since this was a court trial, and the district court did cite to the correct jig in part of the order, and then, you know, went the other way, shouldn't we assume that the district court, as we always do, generally gets it right? I mean, that's not quite the standard, but we sort of give more deference if it's a district court trial than if it's a jury trial, because here are all these findings. And if you look at the order as a whole and everything else, and who threw the first punch, it seems clear that what the district court meant to say was, no. He had, you know, the defendant had the interest in the outcome of the case, and that's what we should be focusing on. Isn't that the stronger argument?
Well, I do think that is the correct analysis of the interest or outcome of the case. I think the judge was just basically using shorthand to say who has more to lose, which is saying essentially the same thing of interest or outcome of the case. There were four witnesses that the judge specifically found more credible. And this goes to, Judge Wheelock, to your question earlier. The last sentence of paragraph 9 on page 12 talks about the court finds Mr. Brown, Miss Brown, Page, and Miss Haig more credible and believable when all the testimony and evidence is considered. So I think that sentence alone also adds to the idea that the judge considered more beyond than just that one factor, the first factor of the criminal jig. It says, all the evidence and testimony considered, I find all these four witnesses more credible. And specifically, he didn't necessarily find the victim and the victim's wife to have no interest in the case. It was when it came down to the neighbor and the teenage girl who was with the group of kids, right, and then says neither of them have anything to gain or lose in this case, and he finds both of those witnesses to be more credible. I think that and giving deference to the credibility standards that the fact finder is entitled to is enough for this court to affirm, and you wouldn't need to reach issue two.
Well, the other two witnesses, that is interesting, because even if it were error to instruct the hypothetical jury using the sieve jig, would we not review for harmless error? I mean, don't we say even if there's an erroneous jury instruction, we can look at whether or not it's harmless, and we look at the strength of the evidence? Do we think it impacted the verdict? And the response there would be, well, we have two witnesses who are no relation to the complaining witness and his wife, and they testified consistently, so that assures us that the error was harmless to the extent there was an error.
Correct. Yes, you would go down the harmless error analysis. I think, Judge Connolly, I think that's probably right, that it would be an error of law to give the sieve jig in the criminal case, but then you would go through the harmless analysis.
There's no likelihood of a substantial effect on the verdict because there was overwhelming evidence of all the other folks testifying.
Correct. In that hypothetical situation, yes.
So that's another way to resolve this case.
There are many ways to resolve this case, but yes, that is definitely one.
Well, including reversing for a new trial.
Including reversing for a new trial. That is another way to resolve this case should you go down that path. Unless you have questions about the self-defense argument, I will rest on my brief on that issue.
I don't see any questions. Thank you.
You affirm. Thank you.
Okay, I have a few points to make here, and I'll try to get through them as quickly as possible. First, of course, I want to address Judge Conley's question, which is whether this court needs to address the second issue, and I think absolutely it does. If this court agrees with me on issue one and finds that this was an improper credibility determination, then, of course, that factors into the self-defense analysis.
I think the question is, if we disagree with you on issue one, do we need to reach issue two?
And in that case, I acknowledge that makes issue two a weaker issue, but I think it is still a live issue, and that's because the district court's credibility determination all came down to who threw the first punch. And yes, if you're deferring to the finding that D did, it's a different situation. But we still have a lot in the record showing, I mean, Dee testified he was 14 years old. He was 120 pounds, 5'4". I went back through TB's testimony. He was a 50-year-old grown man, and he was weighed.
So your argument is, even if he threw the first punch, he still had a valid self-defense or defense of other claim.
Yes, absolutely. He is a small child. This is a large grown man, who, you know, in Dee's testimony, in everybody's testimony but his own, is yelling and screaming and very upset with these children.
So do you disagree that there is a duty to retreat when you're claiming defense of other?
I think there's an unqualified, or I'm sorry, there is a qualified duty to retreat. I mean, it can't be the case that, you know, just because you're defending somebody else, you can go attack somebody. And I think that there is a balance here between the public policy concerns regarding, you know, avoiding violence if possible, but also being able to use reasonable force in defense of others. Because it doesn't make any sense to say that just because you can get away, that you can't defend somebody who can't, or you don't know that they can't.
But if the district court correctly believed that the child threw the first punch, doesn't that show that the child was the initial aggressor and we don't even have to get to the duty? The state just has to disprove one element of self-defense.
I don't think so, Your Honor. And that's because we have, you know, as respondent pointed out, the district court found PLB's testimony to be credible. And what she testified is that TB was acting very intense and aggressive and was up in HD's face. And this is a 14-year-old child who is much, much smaller than this grown adult. And I think you can have an actual and reasonable belief that you could be facing bodily harm without actually being punched first. I don't think the law is that you have to be punched before you can act in self-defense. And I think there is a lot in this record to show that he...
How did the confrontation start?
It really, all the witnesses kind of say it differently. So what we know is that L was said some very disrespectful things to PB, and there was conflict there. The witnesses all differ in terms of who was most upset there. Everyone agrees that after L apologized, everything was de-escalated. According to both D and HD and also PLB, that's when TB started getting very intense and aggressive with HD and some of the other children. And so I think it is an extremely fact-intensive inquiry, and that's why I do think it makes sense to send it back to the district court to say, okay, when you're applying the correct standard, then how do you think about this testimony? Because I don't think that this court can make that determination. It's all too complicated. But there is certainly plenty in the record to show that he had an actual and reasonable, actual and honest belief that he was in danger of bodily harm and that there were reasonable grounds for that belief.
On the self-defense, I understand your point. I mean, I think it would be a different case if your client did throw the first punch and the victim had like a stick or something or a bat, then I might say, well, you know, maybe there's still some issue of self-defense. But I mean, it was just, I mean, he had no weapon in his hands, the victim. Would that be a fair statement?
I agree with that, but I would, again, point you to the fact that he was
older
a 250.
People, older people are always going to prevail against.
Yeah, a much older person, a much older grown man against a 120-pound
So clearly,
child.
I'm even older than that, so I'd have a better shot against someone who's a Golden Glove.
I think that's how it works, Your Honor.
Because age always brings wisdom, and wisdom, I'd sort of know.
Well,
the
it's supposed to,
boys,
Your Honor.
Right.
And
I got it.
Yeah. I see that I'm running out of time, so that we would ask this court to reverse Dee's adjudication for first-degree assault and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you for the arguments and briefings. Very helpful.
Ms. Schultz, it was a pleasure to see you again. Please give my warmest regards to Abby Rankin.